What can you do for me?
Laird Pride laid on his bed, propped on a mound of pillows.
We will pray.
Pray? You will pray?
Yes, of course. We are priests, are we not? Praying is our want.
Perhaps we might try again with the Soul Stone to make Laird Pride more comfortable.
Perhaps you would be wise to do so.
Brother Bathalace nodded.
Oh, to what end? You are old, good Laird. When we grow old and we die, the gemstones are no relief from the inevitable. They cheat not death unless it comes for one wounded or prematurely ill. Are you afraid of dying, Pride? My old friend, I will join you in the next life soon enough, I am sure. As you will, Renark. And are you equally afraid?
What Father Jarek means
has already been spoken.
There is nothing?
My old friend, now comes the mystery. We are creatures of faith, for without it, we are nothing more than the goats and sheep that graze in our fields. I follow a bell, and I believe in his promise of redemption. You will find its truth before I do. Take heart.
What can you do for me?
Father Jarek fell back from the bed, and Brother Bathalace quickly replaced him. In one hand he clutched his hematite, the soul stone, and he put his other hand flat on Pride's chest. Bathalace concentrated and sent his healing powers through the stone, and it did seem as if Pride did breathe a bit easier then, though only for a short time. Behind Bathalace, Father Jarek began to silently pray. Behind him, Renark turned away.
You raise their expectations.
Jarek scolded his companion on their walk back from the castle to Chapel Pride.
I offer them hope.
Where there is none, or at least none for an outcome that cannot be. The Laird will die within a week, likely this very night, and would so fail even if all the brothers of our order crowded about his bed, soul stones in hand. You disagree?
This is about more than the death of Laird Pride, I fear. Pride is off at war, and you saw how Renark viewed us.
Renark is a scowling idiot.
One who will soon enough gain full power in the holding.
Jarek shrugged as if it did not matter.
We fancy ourselves to be healers.
We alleviate as much suffering as we can. If I could cure age, would I need your arm to get through a 50-foot stroll?
Your bluntness.
Speak your mind.
You offered no hope to them. Even if that hope was a false one.
You suggest that I should lie to my old friend.
Bernivagar was at Laird Pride's bedside earlier this day and last night.
Preparing him for death. That is all the Samhays do, of course. Their entire religion is based on the inevitability of death. They mete out harsh justice so that the common fools can see death firsthand, offering them an illusion of conquering it. And the Samhays dismiss the dead as inconsequential, even as they pretend to consecrate the ground that holds the corpse.
And are we not an alternative to the Samhaists? Is that not the message of the Blessed Abel, that we are the light to defeat their darkness?
We are. We are a hope for life after death. But we cannot prevent the passage of the body from this world.
Renark wanted more from us.
Renark is an old fool.
Laird Pride hoped for more from our gemstones.
I hope for more from our gemstones. Laird Pride is afraid, and who would not be? He goes to that place from which none has ever returned. He goes on promises and prayers, and nothing more. That is faith, my friend. And it is a terrifying thing when at last we are forced to take the great leap from life.
That very night, the monks of Chapel Pride were summoned to the castle.
He will not last the night.
The two monks hustled by the guard as fast as Father Jarek could manage and went to Laird Pride's private chambers. They came into the anteroom of the Laird's bedchamber to find Renark inside.
We will offer the sacred rite of passage.
Renark nodded, not to them, but to the guards, who promptly blocked the way.
Bernivagar is with him.
Laird Pride is of the Church of Blessed Abel, is he not? As he accepted the sacred rite of birth and the sacred rite of second affirmation, the second rite of passage is expected and expressly granted.
The Samhasts have rituals of their own to ease the way into death.
Ours is to prepare the dying for their meeting with Blessed Bel. On his word alone shall a man know the joy of paradise.
Renark shrugged. The guards did not move aside.
Perhaps in the end, Laird Pride was persuaded by the honesty of your rival. You could not cure him, and neither could Bernivagar, but at least the Samhazed never pretended that he could.
Nor did we, against your protests. This is madness, Renark. Laird Pride long ago embraced the Church of Blessed Abel and commissioned our chapel to build right beside his own castle. There can be no doubt as to the road of his faith.
A dying man chooses his own path, Father.
Father Jarek had to wonder about that. He was no fool and was not unversed in matters politic. Jarek understood the reality of this moment. When Laird Pride passed on, Renark would likely step in as ruler of Pride until Prince Pride returned from the Powry War, if that ever happened. This ending, right down to the call for the monks to quickly come to the castle, had been orchestrated by the shrewd old advisor for a very definite effect. Renark was sending a clear message to the brothers of Blessed Abel, not one of outright rejection, perhaps, but one designed to remind them that they remained no higher than second in the hierarchy of Pride, a very distant second.
Let us go to him at the end. Allow Laird Pride the benefit of both blessings, Abel and Samhaste. In the end...
Old Bernivagar stepped out of the room.
The Laird of Pride Holding has passed from this world to the ghostly realm. We are diminished as the ghosts about us grow stronger. Let us prepare an appeasement ritual to them.
The Laird is dead! Long live Laird Guest Renark!
Bathalace's eyes went from the Samhaste to the new ruler of Pride Holding. Never had Renark shown any love for the Church of Blessed Abel. Without another word, without a look at anyone, and pointedly none at all toward the brothers of Abel, Bernivagar walked past the monks and the others and left the castle.
We will formally declare the transfer of power tomorrow morning. We are done here. You may return to your beds or your prayers or whatever it is you brothers of Abel do at this hour.
You and I must talk at length, Laird Guest.
In time.
Though soon, most of your subjects are among the flock of...
In my good time, good father.
Branson watched Garabond at work on the small rock jetty one damp morning. The sky was low that day and soft with a misty rain. Garabond sat hunched over, working with his nets in line. He was getting older now. He had just passed his 50th birthday, and the toll of the hard work showed, particularly on wet mornings such as this. Branson knew that he should be out there helping with the lines and stitching the nets. Other boys his age were actually doing the fishing and the farming now, with so many of the older men off at war. That was why men had sons, after all, to take up the chores that they could ease the toil on their old bones.
But not with me. I'm more trouble than I'm worth to him. And still he loves me so and never complains.
At that moment, in that soft light and quiet air, Branson wished he could draw. He wished that his hands would stay steady enough for him to trace lines on a piece of parchment, that he could create a lasting image of his wonderful father out there, quietly toiling, uncomplaining, as constant and solid as the lake and the rocks. When he looked at Garibald, Branson understood all that was good in the world. He felt nothing but unconditional love from the man and for the man. He would do anything to help Garibald. But that was the rub, he knew, the source of his greatest frustration, for there was rarely anything at all that he could do to make the man's life easier. Quite the contrary. Even when he went into town on errands, he knew that it was more for his own sake, for his expressed need to be independent, than for any true gain to Garibald. For more often than not, Branson returned from town with goods spilled and lost in the dirt. He wasn't even 10 years old, and he knew the truth of it. He swiveled his hips and did his stork walk back into the house, where he collapsed on his bed. He fell asleep and dreamed of fishing beside his father. He dreamed of walking, of running even. He dreamed of telling his father that he loved him, without spit flying and without turning a simple word like love into a rattling cacophony of half-bitten syllables.
The clouds are lifting. Do you mean to waste the whole of the day on your bed? Come along, I need to collect some vines.
I would just slow you.
Nonsense. And even if you do, I'd rather take 3 hours with your company than spend an hour alone. Come on, then. I get lonely out there.
You chose this life.
I did.
You like alone.
I thought I did. And now I prefer you.
No.
What is the matter, Branson?
I should be dead.
Don't you ever say that.
Yes.
No. And don't you ever think that. You are alive, and that's wonderful for all the trouble. You're alive because your mother... Because...
The older man sat down on the cot and pulled Branson down beside him, gently draping his arm across the boy's shoulders.
Don't you ever say or even think that!
But...
I once thought the same thing when you were born. And the trials you face pain me every day, probably more than they pain you. You're such a strong one inside. The Samhasts say that any child born less than perfect is meant as a sacrifice, and that is still the way in many towns, but not for you, because of your mother. I haven't told you enough of Senui, Branson, and what a special woman she was. You know that you got part of your name from her, and that she died when you were born. The rest of your name came from your father. No. I gave you that surname, as was my right. Your father's name was Bran. Bran Dinard, a monk of the Brothers of Abel.
The boy's jaw drooped open wide, drool escaping unheeded.
I am not your father, Branson. Though no man could love any child more than I love you.
The boy began to slowly shake his head. Tears welled in his eyes and rolled down his cheeks, and he began to tremble so fiercely that Garibald had to hold him tight to keep him steady.
Please forgive me. You are old enough now. You need to hear this. All of it. You need to know about Bran, my dearest friend in all the world. You need to know about Senui. She didn't just die when you were born, Branson. She gave her life to you so that you could live.
The older man rose then and slowly moved across the room to the trap door leading to the tunnels below.
You were dying even as you were born. You were too weak to draw breath, and Senui wasn't much better off after the birth. But she was no ordinary person, your mother.
He reached down and lifted the door, and then removed one of the sideboards of the solid wood casing. He reached into the hidden compartment and pulled forth a thick book.
She was a jester too mystic. A magical person, more so even than those brothers with their gemstones. Your father went to her land to convert her people to his religion, and wound up seeing the truth in Senui's beliefs.
Garibald presented the book to Branson.
It's all in here. All the secrets.
My father...
Senui knew that you both were dying.
So she used her magic to give you what was left of her own life so that you could survive.
Garibald rushed to him and held him and let him cry it all out. For more than an hour, he sat with the boy, gently patting him.
I love you, Branson. Never forget that. This changes nothing. I love you, boy.
For more than an hour, he told Branson that he was old enough to learn of these unsettling things and promised the boy over and over that he would understand just how special he was when he heard the full story of his mother and father. Finally, Branson composed himself enough so that Garibald could pull him back up to a sitting position, and then the older man truly began the story. He told Branson of his younger days with Brandenard, of how Bran had entered the Church of Abel, but Garibald had not. He spoke of Bran's travels to the strange lands south of the southern mountains, relating all the stories Bran had told to him of the bear and the jester too. His good eye sparkled when he talked of Bran's return to Pride Holding, Senui at his side, determined to enlighten his brethren about the beauties he had learned among the jester too.
That first day back was troubled, though. Your father and mother came across a woman who had been tried and convicted before Bernivagar. He condemned her to death, and so she was bitten by a deadly snake and hung up to die slowly and painfully out along the southern road. Powries were there with her, dipping their caps in her blood. But your mother and father fought them away. And then your mother used her mystical powers to cure the poor girl. Aye, but in that she brought the poison into her own body. And it was the same poison that so hurt you and her in the end. Your affliction is because of generosity, my son. That might make it seem harder, I suppose. But to my thinking, it makes you no less a hero than your mother.
Is she still alive?
The poor girl? Well, I've no idea to tell the truth. If she's not, then it has nothing to do with that day 10 years ago. She left here of her own accord, walking with strength. And all because of your mother.
But my father...
Your father? He was sent away by Father Jarek. Jarek did not much like your mother, for her powerful religion threatened him, I think. He didn't want to hear what your father had to tell him, so he sent your father away to the north, to Chapel Abel on the Gulf of Corona. I don't know. We never heard from him again. He may be up there at Chapel Abel to this day, but Father Jarek's been telling me that he never got there at all. I do not know what to believe, Branson. And I cannot believe that I told you all this in one sitting. But you had to know. And you have to know that this changes nothing between us. You and me, we're family. Father and son, as far as I'm concerned. And don't you ever say to me again that you should die. Don't you ever...
Garibald couldn't hold the scowling pose, and he fell forward, wrapping Branson in a tight and loving hug, and he held him there for a long, long time. Garibald watched Branson closely in the hours following their talk. He had placed so much on the shoulders of the frail boy, too much, perhaps. Branson, whose face was far too numb to show any but the most extreme emotions, seemed to move about with his typical posture and demeanor, giving Garibald few clues. He kept going back to the thick book, however. He'd stand beside it and run his fingers over the cloth cover, staring down as if he were trying to somehow connect with his mother through those mystical pages.
Do you know what a book is?
Garibald gently pulled open the cover of the tome. He watched Branson as he did and was surprised at how the boy's eyes lit up and at the sudden look of curiosity that crossed Branson's face as he leaned in closer to see the gracefully curving letters.
Your father penned it, one line at a time. It took him years.
As he spoke, Garibald ran the tip of his index finger under the first line of the text, right to left, as Senui had taught him.
Each of these lines is a letter.
He took Branson's hand and moved it across one complete word.
Foot.
Branson stared at him, then nodded, and looked back at the page. Garabond was tired from his long work that morning and even more from revealing so much painful information to Branson. He wanted nothing more than to eat his supper and go to a well-deserved night's rest. But he could not deny the look on Branson's face, and given his fears that he had overwhelmed the boy with sorrowful news, he understood his duty here. He went through each of the letters as Senhui had done with him. He pointed out and spoke aloud all the familiar words he could readily find on a page, then read complete sentences. Garabond remembered Senhui's plea to him that he teach the Book of Jest to her child. He considered the high hopes, the promise held by the coming baby, and he had to fight back tears over and over again. For now, he considered the futility of his exercise. What might he really teach this idiot boy who could barely manage to walk and talk? But Garabond quickly pushed those negative thoughts away.
Life.
That's right! You're getting it! You're getting it!
This exercise wasn't about the boy, the lonely older man soon realized, but for him. This was a way to reconnect with those lost to him, to hear again the voice of Brother Brandenard and that wonderful wife of his. Finally, the daylight faded too much to continue, and Garabond rose to leave, closing the book. Branson clutched it close and would not let it go. Smiling, nodding, Garabond let him keep it. A short while later, candle in hand, Garabond checked on the boy to find him sleeping restfully, more so than Garabond had expected given the revelations of the day. His arms wrapped around the book, holding it close to his chest, his head on the clothing of Senhui. The smell of brine hung thick in the air, and with great hopes and great hunger to be done with this awful campaign, the men of the many holdings pressed forward. The intensity of their charge drove the bloody-capped dwarves before them. Led by their eager young prince and by the mighty Banagran, the men of Pride Holding drove hard from the southern end of the line. Banagran charged out in front, his heavy axe clearing the way of Powrys with powerful sweeps. One dwarf got past that flashing blade and rushed hard at the large man's side, short sword leading. It clipped Banagran's hip. Out snapped Banagran's hand, catching the dwarf by the front of its leather tunic. Up into the air went the Powry, soaring over the bridge line to bounce down the rocky eastern side. Propelled by the warrior's gains, Prince Pride led the rest of his forces in a sudden charge up the ridge. The Powrys broke before them, affording them the high ground and offering a moment of respite from the nearly constant fighting of that morning. As soon as he was clear, the prince rushed up beside his friend and clapped Banagran on the shoulder.
We have met our objective, and the sun has not yet reached its apex. Is our work done this day?
It came to us too easily.
Let us press on.
We risk leaving our support behind.
To the east a bit, but then north. Let us turn the end of the line so that the Powrys cannot flee around us.
Banagran looked back to the battlefield in the north across the broken and rocky terrain. All seemed quiet in the east after all, and the day's fighting was not half done.
You take half our charges and move straight north in support of the men of Laird Ethelbert. I will hold your eastern flank with the other half, and will spread my forces out in a secure line north to south to ensure that I am not flanked.
The daring young Prince of Pride.
One of Lord Ethelbert's commanders had just brought news of the unexpected northward curl of the Army of Pride Holding.
Ever out in front is that one.
The Powrys break before his ranks. The men of Pride have marked themselves well.
Yes, particularly Pride's large friend. One victory after another for the men of Pride. Tell your men to take the valor of Pride Holding as their example. Let us press forward as Pride and his forces seal the trap. The more Powrys we kill now, the fewer we will have to kill later. Perhaps this day will mark the end of our troubles. So, valiantly, one and all of Ethelbert, the completion of our task lies before us this day, and the road home is at hand!
The men of Ethelbert Holding charged forward against the fierce dwarves. Their advance inspired those armies of the lesser holdings flanking them to fight on more courageously. Laird Ethelbert shifted his gaze from his own men to the Army of Pride, who were forming a line east to west, up one side of a ridge and down the other. Still, the Powrys broke before them as they made their way north. Ethelbert wondered if he might be watching the champion he would name as heir to Ethelbert Holding. The Pauris continue to break ranks and flee, and the men of Pride, led by their new champion, Bonagran, eagerly gave chase. Even those at the end of the line looked ahead more than behind as they swept along the ridgeline, which was exactly what the Pauris had anticipated. Standing in the center of the two lines, Pride clearly saw the first signs of the counterattack. Pauris leaped up from concealment in the rocks and pressed against the trailing edges of the Pride line.
Hold, Bonagran! Tighten the ranks!
Pride moved south along his trailing forces. There was no time for Pride to stop and think about it, for the fight was on at the southernmost end of the line, his soldiers already surely pressed by a score of dirty dwarves. Pride batted aside one thrusting a sword, then backhanded to clip off the head of a spear. Then he ducked to avoid a second spear thrown from somewhere in the rear ranks of dwarves.
Fight, men! Fight!
He forced himself to press on, for he knew that to run was to die, that the dwarves had them caught, whatever the outcome might be.
Hold strong! Fight them, I tell you! Hold strong! Bonagran! Bonagran!
Bonagran broke ranks and charged toward him. Pride never heard him. Pride never noticed the dwarf on the ground, reaching for its spear. Suddenly, the prince felt a fiery explosion erupting through his groin. He was already falling before the nearest Pauri slugged him. Pride hit the ground hard, his loins torn and bloody, fires of pain coursing through his body. He saw only a blur as a large foot planted itself on the ground in front of his eyes.
Rally, men! Rally around the prince! Protect your liege!
Bonagran set himself solidly, a foot on either side of the prone and unmoving prince. All around him, the men of Pride tried to rally, but the dwarves came on in force from all sides. One dwarf came at Bonagran hard from the side, and he brought his weapon up to meet the charge. All around Bonagran, his men were falling, and there remained Pride, lying so still. He got hit hard in the ribs, but shrugged the pain away. As he spun again, his axe flying, his weapon came together with a dwarf's axe at an awkward angle, and it rolled right up the shaft. Bonagran managed to wrest the axe from the dwarf's hands, but he clipped his own hand on the sharp underside of the dwarf's weapon, the blade cutting through his leather gauntlet and gashing deep into his skin. Bonagran ignored the angle of his pinky finger, obviously severed and hanging in the torn glove. He couldn't afford to feel that pain at that time. Despite the strength of his movements, Bonagran saw the truth. The men of Pride could not hold back this force. Pride was doomed. He was doomed. And all of Pride's army was doomed.
Ethelbert! The Laird of Ethelbert is come!
Bonagran took a moment to look back over his shoulder and regard the scene. Rolling through the rocky dale to the north came the forces of Ethelbert Holding, chasing the Pauris before them.
Hold strong, my liege! Our salvation is at hand! Laird Ethelbert has come! Fight on, men of Pride! The day is yet to be won!
Pauri swarmed Bonagran then, and he went into a fit of battle rage. And he held his ground, his legs as solid as if rooted deep into the earth. He was only half conscious when another mass of Pauris came by him, but enough aware to hold his strike. The men of Ethelbert Holding flowed past their Pride brethren, driving the dwarves away. Thousands lined the streets of Pride Town on the day the men came home from war. Bright banners waved from every rooftop. Prince Pride led the solemn procession of returning warriors. He sat astride a large roan stallion, riding somewhat gingerly, but holding his shoulders proudly squared. Bonagran, with a multitude of new scars, rode beside him. But other than those two, the procession consisted of footmen alone, dirty and ragged footmen, men weary of war and dirt, ill-nourished and battered. Men with hollow eyes that had seen too much. Men with heavy hearts that had known too much pain and too much sorrow. They and their comrades of the other holdings had driven the Pauris to the sea and had all but eradicated the threat of the vicious, bloody-capped dwarves. But the victory had been long and costly. When Prince Pride had ridden out of Pride Holding 3 years before, he had led a column of more than 3,000 men. Barely 1,200 returned. and nearly half of those carrying wounds that would follow them for the rest of their miserable lives. Still, as the procession entered the southernmost stretch of the town and became almost immediately engulfed in the sounds and sights of the cheering throng, to a man, they found their spirits lifted, and Prince Pryday rode a bit straighter in the saddle, and Bonnegran managed to smile. They continued their march through the town and toward the castle, where Pryday would be formally crowned as Laird of Pride Holding within the week. Couriers had told the prince of the death of his father. At the rear of the battlefield, Laird Ethelbert had even held a memorial for the lost Laird Pride and a celebration for Pryday. But Pryday hadn't yet been able to properly mourn his loss, and so his heart remained heavy as he moved along the road, despite the cheering and the dancing. These were his people now. This was his holding now. He felt a twinge down low, an uncomfortable reminder that he would quite possibly be the last of his bloodline to hold the title of Laird.
Are you all right, my liege?
It is all the same, yet all so different.
After the sights of war, it is indeed.
Even as he started to answer, Pryday's attention was caught by the spectacle of a young boy off to the side of the road up ahead. He was dancing, or moving at least, in an awkward manner, his head lolling from side to side, spittle glistening on his face. A man long in years, but still looking quite solid, sat on the ground beside him, obviously trying to calm him. But the boy was clearly taken with the excitement and seemed on the very edge of losing control as he flailed about. Pryday made eye contact with the curious creature, and it seemed as if that link almost drew the boy forward as the prince walked his stallion by. The boy staggered out. The man overseeing him tried to grab him, but the stiff-legged creature staggered forward suddenly out of the man's reach. The youngster lurched out into the road, arms flailing, legs striding this way and that without apparent control. Friday's expression turned to one of horror as the creature stumbled against the flank of his horse, against his own leg. He instinctively pulled his foot from the stirrup and kicked out hard, sending the boy staggering back.
Control that beast!
Pardon, my lad. We beg your pardon. He did not mean...
Friday wasn't even listening and just marched his horse along. A soldier from the ranks behind him rushed out and roughly pushed the man and the boy back from the road, both of them going face down in the mud.
My people... Oh, joy. The pleasure of lads to suffer the likes of the peasant rabble.
Prince Pryday wasn't surprised to see Father Jarek and Brother Bathalace waiting for him inside the castle. Renark, lean and sharp as ever, sat at the front of the throne room in a seat set just to the side of the throne, as was the custom. And Bernivagar, yet another remnant of a past age, stood nearby, tall and straight as always.
My prince, heavy are our hearts with grief at the loss of your father.
Old men die. It is the way of things.
We are glad that you have returned to us, warrior prince. Greater is Pride Holding now that the line of Pride is restored.
The line of Pride, Brother Bathalace? How eternal shall that line be, pray tell?
They knew Pryday reasoned. Of course they did. For the monks at the front lines would have spread word far and wide of the battlefield casualty, that the gelded prince of Pride would likely sire no children. All eyes turned to Bernivagar.
To put your faith in the trickery of the upstarts is to invite disaster.
Our brethren have saved many lives at the front. Prince Pryday's among them.
Ah, limited miracles, then. An interesting concept.
And what shall the Samhasts offer Prince Pryday beyond your clever insults?
We shall see.
My, pardon my prince, who is soon to be rightful Laird of Pride. The brothers of Blessed Abel have prayed for you every day. We are pleased that your life was saved, but sorrowful for your loss, which is a loss to all the lands of Hans. We have done all that we could and will continue our efforts on your behalf. A collective of our most powerful brothers, with the soul stones of the greatest godly energy, can be called together at any time.
Many would make the pilgrimage to the aid of Prince Pride, no doubt. Perhaps even some of our masters from Chapel of Bell.
Though you know that you can do nothing, would you stretch out hope indefinitely to avoid the inevitable realization by Prince Pride that there is really nothing your church has to offer him?
Perhaps you would do well to hold your tongue, old Samhast.
I have held several tongues, cut from the mouths of undeserving fools, muting them so that others could be given back their lost voices.
Father Jarek, I am not without gratitude for the work of your brethren out on the battlefield. Surely I would have expired had it not been for them. Rest easy here, I pray you, and know that the brothers of Abel showed themselves well in the east. Let us end this useless bickering.
Yes, my liege.
We have other matters to attend. Prince Laird Priday should be crowned within the week. The event will heighten the celebration of our glorious victory over the Bloody Caps. Their scourge is lifted from the land, and never again will the men of Hunts have to fear powery raiders along our roads.
That last remark had Priday and Bonnegran exchanging looks, for it wasn't quite true. Victory in the east had been substantial, and the blood of thousands of Powry stained the coastal rocks and had turned the tides red for many days. But Laird Ethelbert and Laird Delaval, the two men truly in charge of Hans's arrayed forces, had stopped short of eliminating the Powrys altogether, and both Bonnegran and Priday knew well that it was not because of battle weariness and not because the two lairds simply could not have pressed farther. No, the decision to allow the Powrys some escape had been a calculated one, as almost all the lairds at the front had learned. The Powry threat had to be kept at a minimum to allow for trade and for the coming consolidations the two great lairds planned, but at the same time, the Powry threat had to remain at the edges of awareness, so that all the lairds of the land could keep their people properly afraid of the world beyond their borders. With tales of Powrys and goblins lurking in the forests, the peasants would not question the demands of their protector lairds.
You may leave us, but Nivagar, you stay a bit longer.
It is good that the brothers of Blessed Abel were able to save your life, good prince. An empty place would be Pride Holding without the proud son of Laird Pride.
Priday didn't respond to Father Jarek other than to offer a quick nod.
We have much to attend to, my lad in waiting.
Priday turned away from the old laird guest to focus on Bernivagar.
You speak of the sacrifice of a tongue to restore the voice of another.
Indeed, it has been done. Other sacrifices have not been so successful, of course.
To what does this apply?
To anything. If the sacrifice is appealing to the Ancient Ones, I have seen men slaughtered so that others could rise up from their graves. I have seen eyes plucked out to make worthy men see. As for your infirmity, you fear that you are the end of the line of Pride.
There is little left to dissuade me from that conclusion.
Castrating another might bring relief, depending upon the extent of your injuries and depending upon the whims of the Ancient Ones.
The whims?
That is the way of the gods, my lord. Among men you stand tall. Among the folk of Pride Holding, you are practically a god yourself. But among the Ancient Ones, we are all rather small.
What would you have me do?
Find a sacrifice, of course.
What requirements?
That he has testicles, my lord. Any man will do, though I would not recommend an old and shriveled specimen. There is a rather odd boy about the town.
Not that stork creature.
Why that one was ever allowed to continue to draw breath, I do not know. The Ancient Ones surely show no favor to a creature so inferior and damaged as he.
The boy on the road? The one who staggers every step and has a face full of snot and drool?
A wonderful specimen, is he not? Perhaps when I am finished with him, with your permission, of course, my lord, I can mercifully put an end to his thoroughly wretched existence.
Priday licked his lips nervously, then turned to Renark.
Do we know where this creature lives?
Garabon watched as the woman he believed to be Callan Duarne, who had stubbornly called herself Ada Whalen, and her young daughter walked away from his house on the lake. They had come back to his home after having helped he and Branson after their rough treatment at the hands of the soldiers. Garabon hadn't recognized the woman at first, and the truth of her identity hadn't even registered to him during their walk out to his house or during the short visit of the woman and her daughter. It wasn't until she was leaving, actually walking away, when she had uttered the words.
A good deed repaid.
Watching her now, though her back was to him, the man understood the truth beyond any doubt. That was her, Callan. Garabond was glad to learn that she was still alive, that she had gotten through her ordeal and had even managed, apparently, to remain in Pride Holding, in Gorham's Hill, on the far western edge of the town proper, she had told him. Somehow, seeing her alive bolstered Garabond's spirits, even beyond his simple sympathy and empathy toward her. Somehow, the fact that she had gone on, had even given birth to a beautiful daughter, made the sacrifices of Senui and now poor Branson somewhat more tolerable.
She's my friend.
What a beautiful little friend you've got there, Branson.
I'm going to marry her.
Garabond's smile nearly took in his ears, and he squeezed Branson up close to his side and continued to watch the departing pair. He knew that such a thing could never be, of course.
She'll be a fine wife to you.
Why would he deprive Branson of his dreams, after all? What else could the poor boy possibly have? When he looked at Branson then, his thought was only reinforced, for rarely had Garabond seen Branson smile so widely. And Branson didn't look back at him, didn't even seem to feel the weight of Garabond's gaze. No, he kept staring out the window at Kaydale, and he kept smiling.
Well, I must get myself cleaned up and get some dinner to cooking.
As he stood there stirring the pot, Garabond wondered about the boy's smile. Glad he was to see it after their humiliation in the town. How horrible that had been. But more horrible for him than for Branson, Garabond understood, if for no other reason than the fact that the boy was quite used to such humiliation. He second-guessed himself for all those occasions he had allowed Branson to journey into the town on an errand. True, Branson was always eager to go, and often begging to go, but had there been a single occasion in the last 2 or 3 years when the boy had gone to Pride Town and had returned without mud on his clothing or blood somewhere? Given the experience today, Garabond realized more fully that many of those falls were far from accidental. He thought of Denard and Senui as he stood there cooking. He watched the swirl of the stew, the thick liquid rolling back over to flatten the wake caused by the passing spoon, and that motion invited him to look more deeply into himself and his life. Garabond the hermit, he supposed, and he thought back to all the disappointments that had led him to this place. It hadn't been a sudden decision for him to move out here and settle in the abandoned shell of a cottage on the small rocky island. It had been a gradual drifting away from the disappointments he always seemed to find when around other people. He remembered when his sister had been killed by Powrys, and how the soldiers of Laird Pride, coming in just moments too late, had been more concerned with celebrating their victory than in worrying about Garabond's grief. While he had knelt there over his sister's body, the soldiers had cheered and danced, arguing over who could claim credit for which Powry killed. The moment of self-pity passed quickly, as it always did with Garabond, and he turned his thoughts to the good things he had known, to Denard again and Senui, who had touched him deeply in so short a time, and of course, to Branson, that awkward and fragile little boy. He considered how frustrated other people always seemed to get when Branson tried to speak, turning a simple statement into a long ordeal. Garabond didn't think of things that way with Branson. To him, the boy's stuttering only lengthened the moment of revelation, like having a hooked fish put up a good and long fight or watching a refreshing spring storm roll in from far away. He looked up from the stew to Branson then, and found that the boy had again taken out the Book of Jest and was now gently moving his hands across the pages. Branson was always at that book, it seemed, ever since Garabond had shown it to him and had spent many days with him trying to explain the lettering. For some reason, Garabond didn't understand, Branson seemed to take a kind of solace in just looking at the flowery text. At first, the man had worried that the clumsy child would damage the book, but it had quickly become apparent to Garabond that Branson was taking more care with the tome than anyone else ever could. So he let the boy play with the book as often as he wished, and he never concerned himself with the well-being of one of the most important artifacts he had to tie him to Senhui, and particularly to Dinard. The two sat down to dinner a little later, the room full of the rich aroma of the fish stew and wood smoke.
Good lettering in that book. You like looking at it.
Branson's face twisted into a crooked smile.
Does it take you away from all of this? Can you forget what happened in the town when you focus on the letters in the book? Bah, what fools are those soldiers?
Branson's smile twisted even more, finally settling into a perplexed expression, or the closest thing the boy could approximate. Branson brought one hand over the table, fingers outstretched and palm down.
This is... take.
His arm shook from the effort as he forced the palm to turn upward without any wild flailing.
This is... receive.
Garabond took Branson's hand and slowly guided it off the table. Even as he brought the arm over the table side, it hit him, and he froze in place, staring wide-eyed at the boy.
What did you say?
Branson's face twisted as he tried to form the words, and he started to turn his hand over again, though Garabond still held it. Garabond did it for him and brought the arm back up over the table.
This is take?
Branson nodded. Garabond turned the hand over.
Receive?
The boy's smile answered it all. Garabond leaped from the table. He scooped up a candle as he went to the book and bent low to study its open pages. And there it was. On the very page Branson had left open, one of the gestitue explanations of the differences of posture, the connotations of movement and position. Those acting in anger or superiority, the text explained, often reached for something from another with their palms down, the inference being that they took what they wanted without regard. Like the soldiers on the road, pushing Branson and Garabond away, like the prince himself, kicking the boy without regard. Those who lived a receptive life, an open existence in which they hoped to and expected to learn from others, must reach out with their palms up, inviting compliance and sharing. But how had Branson figured that out? Garabond had never read him this specific page.
Are you reading this?
The twisted smile, the awkward nod.
Reading?
Branson was setting his jaw muscles so that he could try to answer. He did start to stutter something out, but it was irrelevant to Garabond, who had been thrown into complete confusion. How could an idiot read? How could Branson, a boy who could hardly master the simple movement of putting one foot in front of the other, begin to decipher the intricacies of Dinard's flowing script? He shook his head in denial, then gathered up the book and moved over to the table. He surprised and frightened Branson as he swept the bowls from in front of him. He placed the book down and flipped the pages, coming to one of the early lessons the gestitue placed upon their beginning students. A student would be bound by the ankles to a heavy weight, then dropped into a pool that was just deep enough to keep the student, fully extended, underwater. As with most of the lessons and pages in the book, Garabond possessed only a rudimentary understanding. From what he gathered, the gestitue wanted to see if their students could free themselves without help. The ending note of wisdom on this page, every page had one, went,
in the peace and solitude of the water do we see ourselves.
Reflection.
Yes, reflection. Like when you look into the lake with me. You see what you look like.
No, in water.
The boy closed his eyes. He seemed deep in thought for a moment, looking inside himself.
In water we see ourselves.
So shocked was Garabond by the clarity of the words that it took him a long moment to realize that Branson was poking at the book, bidding him to look. He read the indicated passage, and in light of what Branson had just said, something dawned on him. The purpose of the gestitue test of water was to measure the inner calm of a student. All the students had been shown how to extricate themselves from the binding weights. At issue was whether or not they could do it under the extreme pressure of being underwater. This test was of a person's inner strength, his calm under duress. Garibald had always seen that, somewhat, of course, but the revelation here was not what was on the page in the Book of Jest, but rather the reasoning power of Branson. That, and the fact that the boy could read. How could that be possible? Garibald looked at him and wanted to say something, wanted to pour out all of his amazement and joy. Never before had he looked at Branson in quite this way, and he wanted nothing more than to shout with happiness. But he couldn't. He felt the lump welling in his throat, and he could force no words past it. He reached out and tousled Branson's hair and managed to motion toward the boy's bed. Then he gently closed the book and blew out the candle and waited for Branson to settle onto his bed. Garibald didn't go straight to his own bed. He went to the window and stared up at the sky, which was caught in the last moments of twilight. In a patch where some of the clouds had cleared, he could see the first twinkling stars framed by the rolling dark edges of the overcast. It was a long, long time before Garibald managed to get to bed, and the room was beginning to brighten in pre-dawn glow before he finally managed to fall asleep. Garibald heard the knocking, but it didn't register in his mind. Garibald got quickly out of bed to his feet. He took in the scene immediately. There was Prince Priday and his companion, the warrior of note named Bonnegran. Bonnegran held Branson by the shoulders, his great strength keeping the poor boy almost completely still.
When your lad comes knocking, you would do well to open the door for him.
I was asleep, my liege. Is there a problem?
No problem. We came for the boy, and now we have him.
The large man wheeled about, jerking poor Branson so forcefully that his legs swung out wide. Garibald, dressed only in his flimsy nightshirt, rushed to the door before them.
What are you doing? You cannot take my boy!
Cannot.
But my liege!
Exactly. Your liege. Your lad.
But why would you wish to take him? He is just a child. He's never harmed anyone. Please, my liege, I beg of you to leave him alone. Mercy, my liege, sweet mercy.
Oh, shut up, you babbling fool. And get out of the way before I throw you through the door. The Prince of Pride is in need of your son, and so your son will come to his service.
What can he do? He is just a child and infirm.
Not infirm for our needs, I pray.
Bonnegran wrapped one arm around Branson's chest and leaned back, holding the boy easily from the floor, then reached his other arm around and down the front to the boy's crotch and gave a squeeze.
Yes, he is secure.
Garibald's eyes widened with horror, and he charged forward, or started to, for before he got a single step, Priday had his sword out, its tip against Garibald's chest.
I will forgive you that, just once.
I see that you have secured our sacrifice.
Garibald turned around to see Bernivagar standing there.
Sacrifice! You old beast! Be gone from my home!
The boy will not be killed. He is needed. Take pride that this crippled creature will restore the line of pride.
What will you do to him? He's just a boy.
The ancient ones oft accept such sacrifices.
You just said...
That he will not be killed.
His life is not the sacrifice. This wretched little creature will restore to the new Laird of Pride that which the Bowries took away.
Oh.
If you utter a word of this, I promise that I will cut your face off. That for all of your life you will suffer the screams of revulsion of children and women and even men who cannot withstand the horror of your ugliness. And if you utter a word of this, you will watch your wretched little boy die slowly and painfully.
You cannot! He is just a boy!
The line of pride must continue.
Take me instead!
Do not be a fool. The boy is damaged and infirm.
You should beg us to kill him when we are done removing his genitals. He will have no need for his own virility, obviously. He should have been killed at birth. You know this to be true. So be satisfied that perhaps this little wretch will do some good with his miserable existence.
The sound was more than Garibald could take, and he wheeled around, fist flying and connected squarely on the old Samhaist's jaw. Bonnegran hit Garibald with a thunderous jab.
Perhaps the older man would be better. How old is this boy?
9, 10,
Not yet a man.
Does that matter?
It would be better if he had already reached manhood and was able to sire a child on his own.
Garabond managed to turn to regard the Samhaste standing in the doorway, leaning on the jamb, rubbing his door, and shooting Garabond the most hateful look Pryday had ever seen in all his life.
Accept his offer and spare the boy.
A moment later, Bunnagrand's strong hand hoisted Garabond up to his feet, and the warrior began dragging him out. He managed to look back to the side, where poor Branson was still trying to stand up after being shoved aside by Bunnagrand.
Do not think your crippled son has fully escaped me.
Branson spent all the day at the eastern window of the small house. He was still there when the sun disappeared behind the western horizon.
What will I do? How will I eat?
He wanted to rush out and run to the town to rescue Garabond all the day. That had been his most pressing thought. But he couldn't rush, and he couldn't run. He couldn't do anything. He couldn't even light a candle so that he didn't have to sit there helplessly in the darkness. He wanted to stay awake, to stay alert, to be ready to do whatever he could possibly do to help his beloved father. But eventually, Branson's head dipped down to the windowsill. His sleep was fitful. He looked up, but the horses were already to the side of the window's view. Branson turned and tried to rise, but fell back repeatedly, and was still sitting when the horses thundered away and the cottage door was pushed open. In came Garabond, and he held up his hand to keep Branson back.
Go to bed, boy.
Branson started for his bed while Garabond moved to the table and struck flint to metal to light a candle. Only then did Branson see how bent over and haggard Garabond seemed. And when the man turned, candle in hand, Branson nearly swooned, for the front of Garabond's nightshirt was drenched with blood, waist to knees.
Oh, it is all right. You just go to bed.
Branson fell onto his bed and immediately buried his face. He wanted the world to go away. The rain splashed down all about him, spraying on the rocks and making the lake hiss in frothy protest. The drenching didn't bother Garabond, but only because he couldn't remember a time over the last few weeks when he had felt anything but miserable. His wound had healed, or at least had scabbed over, but that was just on the outside. Bonivagar's brutal work had left him sick inside as well, and he felt as if the festering sore were worming its way deeper into his body every day. The near-constant rain of the last days had added to his misery and had made his daily chores more difficult. The lake was up several inches, so that Garabond and Branson had to abandon the lower house for the time being. Garabond knew that his situation was growing more dire. He knew that his health was fast deteriorating, and even with his stubbornness, he was beginning to recognize that he would not get through this ordeal on his own. He thought of going to Chapel Pride to ask the monks for some magical healing. It wouldn't be easy to persuade them, and he knew it. His injury and illness were due to the order of Laird Pride himself. Garabond wasn't a religious man in any sense of the word, and the distance he kept from the competing factions in Pride Holding in many ways gave him a better understanding of each. Even from afar, Garabond understood the quiet war being waged between Bernivagar and the Brothers of Abel. And the prize of victory, even more than the support of the peasants, was the sanction of Laird Pryday. He slapped the wet rock next to him in frustration, and his hand was so cold and numb that he didn't even feel the sting. Was this numbness akin to Branson's? That notion had him glancing back to the house, where Branson was no doubt sitting on his bed with his nose deep in the Book of Jest. That book had become Branson's life of late, his tie to the past, and...
And what?
Was Branson finding solace within the pages of the Book of Jest beyond anything he had ever expected of the boy? Certainly Branson's apparent understanding of the text had been a surprise to Garabond, but what did the book now hold over him? Was he finding an escape within its pages from the misery of his tortured reality? As he considered these things, Garabond looked at the hissing water. Was there anything life could now offer him to make him desire life? Responsibility for Branson alone was keeping him going, he knew, and now, given his declining health, that too was beginning to worry him. What in the world would Branson do once Garabond was gone? He couldn't fend for himself, and he had no real friends other than Garibond himself. At that moment, a crow flew past Garibond. He gritted his few remaining teeth, blinked his one good eye, and watched the blackbird disappear into the film of heavy rain. A crow. A spy for Benivagar, perhaps?
Bah, you're just being an old fool.
Benivagar's threat concerning Branson had not been an idle one, Garibond understood, for Benivagar was not a man to make an idle threat. In the weeks since his ordeal under the Sam Haste's knife, Garibond had seen Benivagar around the lake, often watching his house from afar, and he knew the old wretch had never given up his desire to sacrifice Branson. He thought again of Callan Duarne, or rather, Ada, and her daughter who had befriended Branson. Many times over the last few days had Garibond considered seeking her out and asking her to take in Branson. But on every occasion, and now again, Garibond quickly dismissed the idea. How could he force this burden upon another, even one who owed her life to Branson's parents? And how could Callan defend the boy if Bernivagar came for him? Indeed, how could she defend herself if the callous old Samhaste wretch discovered her true identity and that she had somehow escaped his punishment?
What am I to do with you, then?
Some hours later, Garibond dragged himself back into the house, where he found Branson sitting and reading, so engrossed that he didn't seem to hear Garibond enter.
You like the book, don't you?
Shaking with every movement, Branson turned his head and managed a half-smile.
I know a place that has many more books you might enjoy.
Again, Branson turned, this time looking more confused than pleased or excited.
The monks in the chapel have shelves and shelves of books. You would like that, yes?
Jest.
Jest? Oh, yes, the Book of Jest, penned by your father. But there are other books, so many more. Books of wisdom and history. You would like that, yes?
Branson nodded, but didn't seem overexcited about the prospect and turned right back to the Book of Jest. His reaction didn't matter. Garibond thought through all the options before him, and the only course possible seemed clear enough. He had to convince Father Jarek to take in Branson and to care for him. That wasn't going to be easy. Certainly not. To Garibond's understanding, the monks of Abel were not nearly as generous as they pretended. Perhaps he could offer the monks something so they would take in Branson. Perhaps that very book now open on the bed. Garibond quickly dismissed that notion, remembering the reaction of the church to the book 10 years before. Besides, how could he explain its existence, given that Sen Wi had made it appear as if the book had been burned? Another thought came to him, an image of a marvelous sword wrapped in cloth in a dry place in his tunnels. Perhaps he could offer them the sword, a weapon unrivaled in all haunts. Yes, the monks could trade the sword to Priday. Surely they would greatly appreciate its workmanship and the power it might offer to them in their battle for the affections of the young laird. That was it then, Garibond decided. The monks were his only option. He did hope that the monks would treat Branson well and that they would teach the boy to read the language of Hans and give him access to their books. Yes, he would have to make that a part of the bargain. Little in life, other than reading, offered pleasure to poor Branson. On the first break in the weather, a couple of days later, Garibond went to Chapel Pride.
My greetings, brother.
And to you. I have no time to hear your woes. I fear I must be straightway back to Chapel Pride.
I know you.
The monk paused long enough to look over the man carefully.
I'm afraid that your recognition is one-sided, friend.
I was a friend of Brother Brandon Ard's.
Again, the monk stopped and studied Garibond, his gaze soon dropping to the man's waist area, which told Garibond that he had been recognized.
You are the one the Samhaeus took for Laird Pride.
Aye. And that's a reputation to put forth, is it not?
I am sorry, friend, that you fell victim to that brutish old man. There is nothing I can do to alleviate...
I'm not here about that, Brother...
Riandu. Brother Riandu.
Ah, yes. I remember our meeting after my friend Brother Denard left for the north. Has there been any word at all?
Brother Denard is believed to have been murdered on the road. That, or he rejoined the Baronese woman and fled the land of Hans, as many brothers believe.
He did not. for she did not survive.
What do you know of it?
I know that she is dead. Long dead, to the loss of the world.
And yet you ask me of Brother Denard?
Of him I know nothing, beyond that he departed from your chapel 10 years ago.
Nor do any of us, Master...
Garibond.
Master Garibond. I feel for your loss, for your friend, and for... well, your ill treatment by Bonivagar.
I need the help of the Church. Not for me and my ailments. Those I accept well enough. But for my son. You know of him, no doubt. He is unique and difficult to miss.
The damaged one. The one they called Stork.
Yes. For him.
If we believed that there was ever anything our soulstones might do for one so damaged, we would have undertaken the task years ago, brother.
You cannot heal his maladies, of course.
Then what?
He is a lot of work, of course. And I am growing old, and more frail because of the Samhaste beast. I fear that I will soon not be able to care for Branson.
You would ask us to take him in?
I would. He needs protecting.
We have not the means, brother. We are not a house for wayward.
Not wayward. I do not ask you lightly to take this burden.
You should ask a friend.
I cannot, for I fear for the boy. Bonivagar got me, aye. But that did little to satisfy his bloodthirst. He wants the boy.
Speak to Laird Priday.
I do not ask lightly you to take this burden. Nor without offering you gain for your church.
Gain for the church of Blessed Abel? You are not a man of wealth or influence, good Master Garibond.
Rightly noted. But I am in possession of an item that would prove quite valuable to you in your dealings with Laird Priday.
Go on.
Do you remember Brother Denard's wife? The bear woman named Senwi?
Yes.
A mighty warrior, so it was said.
Her exploits against the Powrys were spoken of, yes.
With an amazing sword. A sword more grand than anything in all the land of Hants. I assure you that if you heard any tales of that magnificent weapon, they were not exaggerated. Indeed, if anything, the people who saw the blade could not begin to understand its beauty and craftsmanship. It is a sword fit for a laird. Indeed, it is beyond any weapon that any laird in all Hants now carries, or has ever carried.
That is quite a claim.
One I can back up on your agreement to take Branson into your chapel and care for him.
I am not authorized to make such an arrangement.
Of course, but you are capable of relaying my proposition to Father Jarrick in the strongest possible terms.
You would wish us to care for the boy until his death? For decades, likely.
Yes, but he is not without use. He can work for his meals as long as the tasks are within his physical limitations. Oh, yes, and there is one more thing. I want you to teach him to read our language and to allow him access to books.
The idiot!
He is no idiot. Do not confuse physical deformity with mental weakness. It was a mistake that I long made. He can read, I am certain. It is a skill that will allow him to transcend the limitations of his flesh.
I will take this matter to Father Jarrick and Brother Bathales.
Garibond could ask for nothing more. He nodded and rushed away, hoping that Bonivagar had not learned in the meantime that Branson was all alone.
The Saga of the First King is continued on the next disc.